It's Mark Yeagy here, wealth architect and lifestyle investor. Let's take your life to the next level. Welcome to the Wealth Architect Podcast.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Yeagy. Welcome to another edition of the Wealth Architect Podcast. So glad you're here today. We've got a really cool guest today from BFG Financial Advisors. He's the author of the award-winning book, Don't Retire, Graduate. I love that. He and his team believe that financial literacy is the key to financial freedom. Totally agree. And so they provide free and affordable educational resources and accessible financial planning with no asset minimums. Our guest today is Eric Brodmann. Eric, welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, thanks, Mark. It's great to be here. I'm doing terrific.
Super, super. Well, let's talk about, I want to talk about you a little bit just to kind of get to know you. And then, and then maybe we'll just talk about what you can do and how you can help. So tell us a little bit about how you got started and what you're, where you are today.
Well, I got started the traditional way as an English major. I was planning to go. I was planning to go to law school and took a job out of college with English and psychology background. Took a job at a brokerage firm in the legal department, and realized very quickly that I really loved the financial aspect of it more than the legal aspect. So I didn't go to law school, which was the single greatest professional decision of my life. So 31 years ago, I started a practice and decided I was going to work with folks and work with families and help people learn how to make better financial decisions, help folks figure out their own path to financial independence, because there is no one way and every family's different. And I had a chance in 2003 to start a firm and launched BFG at that time. And now 21 years later, we're 20 full-time folks, 8 financial advisors. We have clients in 36 states, and we represent a very broad swath of the population, from private wealth, high net worth investors, to folks who are just getting started and need some basic financial planning. And so that keeps our days a lot of fun.
That's great. So you still love the money game, and you're just trying to get the word out to a lot of people, because financial education is really where it's at. I totally agree, right?
Yeah. I mean, I do love it, but what I love about it is the qualitative stuff. The quantitative stuff, the math is simple. A computer can do the math.
Yeah.
It's how that relates to humanity and goal setting and what's important, and whether it's kids or parents or careers or homes or lifestyles. And it's the qualitative stuff to me that's much more rewarding. The philanthropy can be very rewarding. Watching families succeed is just a gift among, you know, to itself.
Yeah. So what do you guys do? You do, you're a CFP, a certified financial planner.
Yep.
And what does that mean? What tell us a little bit about what that credential means there.
Well, it means two things. One, a certified financial planner practitioner is a fiduciary. So let's first say that we represent our clients and no one else. We don't represent a bank or a trust company or an investment firm or an insurance company or anybody else. We only represent our clients. And that's the first and foremost thing that the CFP credential lends itself to. The second thing is, I would say a CFP practitioner is a primary care physician for someone's financials. And what I mean by that is there are specialists in all of these different areas, real estate or banking or law or tax, and no one can be great at all of it. So what the CFP practitioner does is we take a look at 30,000 feet and build an entire landscape for a family and build an entire plan for a family, and then help them select or engage various specialists to make sure they're being taken care of. So I consider it like a financial physical exam, because if you go to your doctor and say something hurts, but I'm not telling what it is, you're not going to have a great outcome. It's better to get a physical exam first, and they say, hey, you need a podiatrist and a cardiologist, let's get you those. So that's, I think, what makes a CFP practitioner different, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds good. You know, I think so often we get caught up in this credentialed thing, but at the end of the day, you're just a person, right? You're just a person trying to help other people, and you have some designations which give you some first principles. What are some of the first principles that we should all know when it comes to financial planning and our investing?
Well, there's a few, and the first is to make sure that you are looking at this in a holistic way, and you're not looking at these things in a vacuum. Because what feels like a terrific investment or a terrific mortgage, or anytime you listen to the media, and I know it's funny, I have a love-hate relationship with media, but anytime you listen to the media, you're getting advice that's one size fits all, and one size fits no one. So it's really important to take a look at this on an individualized basis. And I think the number one principle is to look at this specifically in your situation. And I would say a very close second, and possibly I even have them reversed, is to have transparent, honest, open communication with your spouse or partner or family members, and to make sure that you are on the same page. It doesn't mean you have to agree on everything. I don't know too many spouses that agree on everything, but you can certainly work together to figure out the best way to move forward. And, you know, when spouses are keeping things from each other, it never ends well. So it's much better to have those communication, that communication, and not to guess.
Yeah, I can't even imagine being in a relationship with someone and having to hide things. Yeah. I mean, maybe people do it as a protective mechanism for the other person, but in some cases, it's probably not, right?
Well, sometimes it's hiding and sometimes it's just no discussion. You know, I can't tell you how many times I sit down with a couple and I say, well, tell me about the house. How long do you plan to stay there?
Yeah.
And one spouse will say another 2 or 3 years, and the other spouse will say forever. And then they look at each other like, holy cow, we never talked about this. And so I think some of it isn't, it's not malicious necessarily. I'm not talking about something that's sneaky. I just think people are busy in our lives. And if you're busy thinking about carpool and kids and your job and your parents and all the stuff that we have to think about, this takes a back seat a lot of times. People spend more time planning a week at Disney than they do planning a 30-year retirement.
Isn't that the truth?
So
let's say I'm a 45-year-old couple and we got $500,000 in savings and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, but we've never really done anything except stick it in the bank and maybe put it in a 401k, some mm-hmm. of it, and mutual mm-hmm. fund. And we walk into you guys. What do you do? Take me through the process of how you can transform, or at least get me on the road to transforming my financial life.
The first thing we're going to do is we're going to send you a welcome kit, essentially, and go through a full questionnaire, a document checklist, and then schedule an interview. And our interviews, the initial interviews, go anywhere from 90 minutes to 2 hours. They're very qualitative in nature. The math speaks for itself. The statements speak for themselves. If you're able to find your wills, your legal documents, your employee benefit handbooks, the deed for your home, your mortgage statement, et cetera, then that almost is self-explanatory. And it's more important to figure out the whys. How did you get here? And why did you make those kinds of decisions? Not to be judgy, but just to understand what's important. And so we do an interview. It lasts, again, about 90 minutes or 2 hours. We charge nothing for that interview. It's a chance for folks to kick our tires, for us to get to know them, for them to get to know us and decide, are we the right co-pilots for their family? And if we decide to move forward, we move forward in one of two ways. One is a financial planning engagement, which is a basic entry-level financial plan. It allows for the coordination of efforts. It allows for some hypotheticals to be run for certain goals, whether it's education or retirement, financial independence. Or we do a private wealth engagement, which is a lot more hands-on. It's more of a concierge physician model where we're actually sitting down with your attorney. We're speaking with your accountant. We're talking to all the various folks in your life. We may be having a conversation with one of your asset managers or your HR department or any number of folks so that we're getting all of that information and making good decisions together. And then we build an agenda together and we start with digging the moat around your castle. I mean, before we can do anything, we have to take inventory. Where are you?
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a mall, the kiosk has the sticker on it that says you are here. And until you have a really good idea of where you are, you can't possibly build a path to where you might want to go.
Got it.
We'll start with inventory. Then we'll find some priorities. If there are things that are urgent or things that are broken, that we'll try to get them fixed. And I look at financial planning. I even said in the book, I look at financial planning a little bit like cooking Thanksgiving dinner, which fortunately for my family and everyone who dines at our place, I don't do. But I understand the premise of cooking Thanksgiving dinner, which is some courses take 12 hours to prepare and some take 20 minutes. And if you put them all in the oven at the same time, you're going to have something very undercooked or something very overcooked. So we start with the things that are going to take the longest, maybe something that takes legal drafting or requires underwriting for an insurance thing or a loan or various things that are going to take time. And hopefully it all comes together to create a beautiful plan by the end of 2 or 3 sessions together. And then on an ongoing basis, we meet with clients either once or twice a year, depending on the level of their engagement. And we do a physical exam once a year. I mean, you don't go to the doctor once and say, all right, I'm good, and then not go again for 10 years. Life changes. And so we want to make sure that we're available. I don't want to sit down with somebody a year or two or five after we've talked and find out, oh, by the way, we bought a boat and we had triplets. And it happens. People do these things, and it's much better to have a dialogue that's constant. So that's what we aim to do.
Well, it brings up a question. Things do change in life, right? And even sometimes, you know, like Mike Tyson said, you know, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the mouth.
That's right.
And
that's right. You know, I remember that. Yeah.
He kind of had a point because, you know, so often we go into these plans and we sit down and we take our time and we're in a very unemotional state, which is the best way to make a plan.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden something happens in the market. We get a market crash or we go to war or there's some Fed decision. You know, a lot of things happen that are outside of our control. You know, the mutual fund that you're in goes down or the stock that you're in goes down. What do you do when you have some of these big events and now you've got a customer banging on your door saying, no, I can't take it anymore. Get me out of this. Get me into CDs.
Fortunately, that happens extremely rarely in our world, and partly because before we build somebody's castle, we dig their moat.
Yeah.
So we make sure that there's an emergency fund and that there's available capital and that you borrow and have lines of credit available when you don't need the money, because once there's a financial emergency and you need the money, no one will lend it to you.
Right.
It's a great conundrum. So we make sure folks are prepared for some of those short-term events. We also make sure that they're prepared for some of the bigger life events, whether that involves insurance or it involves beneficiaries or legal documents or other types of arrangements. We want to make you as bulletproof as we can, knowing that there is no perfect plan. I mean, the perfect plan works no matter what, and there's always curveballs in life. You're 100% right. The discussion around markets, for example, a market change, you know, the news du jour, which, by the way, has been going on since the beginning of news.
Yes.
The news du jour is a very dangerous game to play because if you look for a reason not to invest, you will find it every day somewhere. I think it has more to do with your time horizon. It has more to do with what you're trying to accomplish. And not all of our accounts have to be handled the same way. You know, if you're in your 20s or 30s and you're plowing money into all different things, then by all means, take advantage of a market correction. In 2008 and 9, we learned a lot about that. And I certainly remember Y2K and some of the things before that with the tech bubble. But 08, 09 was a really good example of the only three kinds of investors that exist. You have buyers, you have holders, and you have sellers. The buyers should be looking at an 08, 09 correction as the greatest opportunity of their lifetimes.
Yeah.
Because they're buying. They're suddenly lowering their cost per share, their dollar cost averaging at a time where opportunistically things are on sale. When there's a Black Friday sale on towels at Macy's, there's a line around the building at 4 a.m. But when there's a sale on Wall Street, people think something's defective. It makes no sense. So if you're a buyer, take advantage of that. If you're a holder is somebody who's going to lose time. And in 08, 09, there were folks who held on, and I mean held on with everything they had, knowing that they were going to take a dip and they were going to have to wait for recovery. And some of them wound up losing 3 to 5 years. They really did. And by losing that, I mean they had to work longer than they had intended, or they didn't retire in the way they had intended. But if they held on, they eventually recovered. It wasn't perfect, and it wasn't pretty, and it sure wasn't fun, but they recovered. It's the sellers that get clobbered. Because if you're in that panic mode and you say, oh my gosh, I can't take it anymore, and you're one of the people who sells after the horses have left the barn, you close the door, so to speak, you'll never recover. Never. You can't recover. So I liken the financial world to sort of having an orchard. If you think of an orchard of apple trees, every year the trees should bear fruit. Some years there's more fruit than others for sure, but there should bear fruit every year. If you pick the fruit, you're okay. Eat the fruit. There'll be more next year. If you start chopping off branches or you start cutting down trees, you will by definition have less and less and less fruit. And eventually you will have an empty orchard. And so for sellers, it was important to have a very long runway. And I mean 5 to 10 years of cash or cash equivalents or very low volatility instruments, so that they didn't have to care what their growth funds were doing. They saw it. The statement was there. It was a bite your knuckle kind of moment. But if you have the dry powder, if you have the cash, and you can continue your lifestyle in retirement without having to sell at a low point, you have a much better chance of recovery.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Hey, it's Mark Yeagy here to tell you about our Cash Flow Machine trading program that's designed to teach you how to make safe, reliable income. Now, we shoot for 2 to 4% a month of income and growth in your portfolio. And we have courses to teach you how to do this yourself or inside a mastermind community. And the best part of that is it only takes about 20 minutes a week to implement. Now, while 2 to 4% a month doesn't sound like much, I show you exactly how we took my IRA from $111,000 to over $500,000 in just 19 months without huge risk. I'm not telling you this to brag, just to show you that you could do this too. So to learn more about this program, go to cashflowmachine.io. That's cashflowmachine.io, and you can learn more. And it brings me to a macro question. I didn't know we were going to go into macro, but I kind of have this feeling that I want to talk about it with you.
Okay, sure.
And that is, you mentioned 2008 and 2009. And I'm a believer that inflation and asset prices follow the amount of money printing that we have. So what do you think's going on with the Fed these days, with our debt bubble, with our spiral, with our deficit? What do you think's going on, and what do you think the Fed's going to do, and how's that going to affect assets? Big question.
It's a great question. What I do know, though, is that the show isn't live. So by the time this goes live, it might be a silly answer because things are changing that fast. So there's your caveat. If there's been wild news over the past few weeks, we don't know about it yet.
There's always wild news, Eric.
I know, but I'm hedging my bets, Mark. If I say something that's profound today, it might seem foolish in 3 weeks.
Well, just hold off on the numbers. How about that?
Sounds good. What do I think is happening on a macro level? I think we grossly overprinted money. We devalued our currency. I think our debt is unsustainable. I think at some point those chickens will come home to roost and we will all be punished for it. I do think that you still must own and must diversify. And the only way to make real money in markets is to own things, not to loan. I mean, people who buy bonds do not get wealthy doing it. They might have some safety. And I'm not saying they're a bad thing. There's a place for it.
Talk about safety. Treasuries are down 50% in the last year and a half.
Well, yes, I know. And all of the interest rate hikes, what they meant, we had to change the fixed income in our portfolios in anticipation of an eventual rate hike. And so what we did was we laddered fixed income and we held the maturity so that we didn't care that there was a pullback in market value because we held the maturity. Well, Fast forward, once the interest rates have gone up to what is arguably a normal space, but happened really fast, now we have to go back to a total return because now the laddering may not work. Now we need to prepare for the possibility that existing bonds could be buoyed by falling interest rates at some point. So I don't think you need to be real tactical with stocks. I don't. I think you can mostly index, you can mostly own everything and you're okay. It's inexpensive. And I don't think anyone can beat an index over time. I know it happens occasionally, but I'm mostly passive there. But on fixed income, because it's an infinite universe, I think reading the tea leaves of interest rates is incredibly important, and figuring out how to structure your fixed income does matter. Remember, cash was not an asset class for a decade. It paid zero. So there's an entire generation of investors who don't realize that cash used to be an asset class. And then it became a sock drawer for a while, and now it's an asset class again. So if you can get 4 or 5% on your cash, I know that may not be keeping up with inflation, but it sure beats having it in a coffee can under the swing set, which there isn't any under our swing set, by the way. So don't come try and find that. But, I don't know where this I don't know where the real traumatic event happens. I mean, I don't know too many people who in 2015, for example, said in the next 5 years, we're expecting a global pandemic and this is what's coming. I don't think people are predicting necessarily what's happening from a global warfare standpoint. I mean, I look at what's happening in Ukraine. I look at what's happening in Israel. I look at what's potentially going to be happening in Taiwan, which is very scary. And I see these things, and I don't think it means don't invest, but I think it does mean that there's going to be at some point, there's a tipping point here, right? I don't know where it is, and I don't know when it will come, but I don't think it'll be permanent. So if we plan on the fact that an 08-09 will happen again, It won't be for the same reason. It won't be a credit crisis. It might be something else. It could be an energy crisis. It could be a, it'll be a crisis. There'll be a crisis of some kind.
Of course.
I'm not trying to predict what it'll be or when it'll be or how long it will last. And I'm sure as heck not investing to it. But what I am aware of is if you're 10 years or less from your financial independence target, it is time to make sure that some of that money is ready to deploy no matter what that noise is. And there will be some, and I may it not be too horrible and may it not be for too long, but it'll happen. I don't know where Social Security is going. I know that I could solve Social Security with a yellow pad, an abacus and a pencil in 45 minutes if they'd let me. But unfortunately, the only people trying to fix Social Security are people running for office, and therefore they have to pander one way or the other. You right. can't fix it without someone getting hurt. That's the nature of it. It's the largest defined benefit plan, arguably, in the world. And I could argue it's a Ponzi scheme. Frankly, you need enough people to be putting in order for people to be pulling out. And none of us thought we'd be living to 105, 110, 115 when that went into place. So just like traditional pensions are struggling, so is Social Security. Yeah. It'll get fixed, but it won't get fixed until it breaks fully.
Yeah.
There's no political appetite to fix things that aren't so broken that there's no choice because people don't want to lose elections. And until that mindset goes away, boy, I don't know how you fix the big financial things, but the deficit scares me more than almost any of it because the interest rates, as interest rates go up and some of our national debt has to be refinanced and it's refinanced at a much higher interest rate, a larger and larger portion of our GDP is going to go to debt service. And if that was a household, we would immediately have to come in and take corrective action. But it's a government, so they just print money. And it means that the dollar bill in our wallet will be worth 50 cents instead of 80 cents in that same time frame because inflation's likely to be here for a while, I think.
Yeah. Is there room for an allocation for Bitcoin and gold in your portfolios?
Interesting question. We have not used over the years, we have not used precious metals as an asset in our portfolios. We have used commodities at times, which did include some exposure to that, but we haven't specifically chosen gold as an asset class, mostly because the gold standard doesn't exist. If we were still on the gold standard, I'd feel very differently. If we knew that Fort Knox had enough dollars in the treasury to be worth every ounce of gold, then I'd feel differently. But after the gold standard, we no longer use that. In terms of Bitcoin, I'm not an investor in that, nor am I a proponent of it, primarily because I have yet to discover the ways in which it has actual intrinsic value. I know we've seen these things before. We've seen the French tulips. We've seen things that get people very excited and they start investing all the way up. And there's a very small number of people who sort of know what's happening. And so I think when we look back on Bitcoin and all of the other digital currencies, I think at least initially what we're going to have is a very small number of people making a very large amount of money and a very large number of people losing a lot of money. And that scares me for the masses. Could a digital currency replace the dollar as the reserve currency in the world at some point? I've read some very interesting books that propose that is a possibility. And I don't want to say it's impossible because we could be in hovercrafts too. I mean, the world is evolving very quickly. And if we all have suddenly a robot at home doing the kitchen, the cooking, and we're in the Jetsons, I don't know what's next. But I do know the early adaptation of those types of things tends to work out incredibly well for a very small number of insiders and horribly for everybody else who are cannon fodder. And so I'm staying away from it right now.
You just stay away from it because what you don't know won't kill you. And, you know what you know, and that's where you put people.
If I miss a home run in favor of missing a couple of strikeouts, I'm okay with that. You can single and double your way to the Hall of Fame too. And so I would much rather have some predictability and be able to understand everything that I'm not only owning, but that we're suggesting that our clients own. I want to understand it. Yes. I want to know how it works. I want to know how it makes money. I want to know why there's a profit incentive there. I want to know that it's a reasonable investment, not that it's going to be perfect. Some of them go wrong. Let's face it. But I want to understand it enough to say, yes, there is value here and it is worth putting some allocation into. And I just can't get around that yet with digital currencies.
So your slogan is don't retire, graduate. Can you expand on that a little bit? I think it makes a lot of sense to me, but I'd like to hear more from you.
We have watched over the years, hundreds of individuals and couples retire.
Yeah.
And most of the time, I dare say it doesn't go particularly well. And I don't mean financially. You could have plenty of money, but if you don't have if you don't have purpose, if you don't have a reason to be advancing in your life, then you're retreating and you're disappearing. And in the traditional sense, retirement, to me, it's a fate worse than death. And I don't want to die at my desk either, but I sure want to graduate to another phase of my adult life. It could be half our adult life. You're not talking about I'm going to make it to 65, live to 72, and spend most of that time ill. You're talking about, I want to retire at 57 or 60 or 62. I could live to be 106. I better have a plan, not just for the math, but for something to do. And so, I have a talk that I do that's the three secrets of the happiest retirees. And I'll give you the Cliff Notes version for your show. Number one is to be debt-free, to owe nobody anything. And I know there's good debt and bad debt, and there's leverage. And we could talk about, should I prepay my mortgage? It's at 2.25. And lots of people say, no, of course not, because there's arbitrage. And I get it. But the happiest retirees don't owe anybody anything psychologically. Yeah. The second thing is happy retirees are healthy. They've maintained their health, their ability to do things. What's the sense in having a ton of money but not being able to walk? Yeah. And people who put things off too far, they don't ever do them. They don't ever take those trips because they start to get ill or the spouse dies or something happens. And the third and most important thing is purpose. You know, if you go to LinkedIn as a social media site and you look at what people do, and we all associate who we are with what we do. You know, if somebody says, who are you? People say, I'm an architect. I'm a scientist. I'm an accountant. Well, no, you're not. That's what you do. That's your day job. And if we identify too closely with who we are, with what we do, and then we don't do it anymore, we've lost who we are. And it's insanely sad. And so I think retirement should be something worth celebrating. And to me, retirement is not the absence of work. It's the absence of needing to work. If you're financially independent and you're 37, you're retired. It doesn't mean you should be sitting home watching daytime TV and playing shuffleboard. That's misery. But by all means, you're retired if you are financially independent. And so we help families get to financial independence. But before they give 2 weeks' notice, you got to spend a year or two figuring out what you want to be when you grow up.
So true.
I mean, because it's really, who are we? Who are we and what's important?
What do you mean by graduate?
That's what I mean by graduate. So when you finish any program, whether it's preschool or whether it's a master's degree, there's an end date. And the graduation is an end of something, but really it's a launch pad to something bigger, better, more exciting. You don't graduate and then stop doing things. You graduate and then you start using them in a different way, or you move on to the next challenge or the next exciting thing. There are only two milestones in life right now that do not lend themselves to the next chapter. One of them is a traditional retirement where you're sitting around, and the other is death. And that's why I equate them. Yeah. So why not eliminate one of those and say, look, if retirement is a stepping stone to the next thing, whatever it is, what do you want? How do you want to spend what could be 20 or 30 years? You know, and people say, oh, I'm going to travel. Well, you can do that, but you're not going to travel necessarily 12 months of the year for 30 years. You're going to take a couple of trips, but then the rest of the time, what are you doing? And they say, well, I'm going to volunteer. Great. Make sure you know what's important to you so that you can figure out where you want to volunteer in advance. You don't wake up one day and then suddenly wind up on three nonprofit boards. You have to spend some time building relationships and understanding and volunteering and getting to know the community, and just like you would with a job. So build your network, build your community, and be a member of it. Don't just show up one day and say, I'm gonna volunteer at the food bank for 2 hours. I'm not saying that's not valuable. I'm saying that's not a way to spend 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I love the concept of don't retire, graduate, because I don't think I'll ever retire, really. I like doing things and having a purpose. Those are two things that you mentioned, and those are very, very critical. And hopefully I'll keep the health in order to be able to do that for a long time. So listen, wise words from Eric Brotman today. Thank you so much. How can people get more of you and find out more of what you do and how they can work with you?
Well, our company website is bfgfa.com. That's BFG Financial Advisors. And to learn more about the book and read on some of the white papers and some of the free resources, you can go to brotmanmedia.com, and it's all right there for you.
Wonderful. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time, your wise words, and your wisdom today. I really enjoyed the chat, and I like the fact that you have a nice breadth of not just of knowledge, but a plan, right? And that's, you got to take into account a holistic view of things. And I like the fact that that's kind of the way you talk, and that's the way you approach lots of things, the whole life. And so I appreciate that.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it, and look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Yeah, sounds great. Everybody else, thanks for being here. Thanks for watching, listening, being a part of the Wealth Architect podcast. Remember what I always say, never give up your power and your health, your wealth, or your time. Have a great day, everybody. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Wealth Architect podcast with Mark Yeagy. Follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Like and subscribe on YouTube. Share and tell your friends. See you soon.